Now, in all our analysis on CBDC, in particular for the use of general, to the general use, we tend to establish the equivalence with cash. And there is a huge difference there. For example, in cash, we don't know, for example, who's using a $100 bill today. We don't know who is using a 1,000 peso bill today. A key difference in with the CBDC is that central bank will have absolute control on the rules and regulations that will determine the use of that expression of central bank liability. And also, we will have the technology to enforce that.
Welcome to The Last American Vagabond. I have a very special guest joining me today to discuss something that is clearly one of the most important parts of this larger illusion, if not the most important part. The clip you just saw was in reference to the idea of central bank digital currencies, which we've talked about as well. And what we're going to discuss today is really about how COVID-19, rather the idea of your health, or rather even more broad, the idea of just pandemics in general, are being used as a vehicle to drive in something that has always been there, something that's been an agenda for a very long time. And so we're going to discuss how that's being used and how that will potentially be going forward unless we do something about it. And joining me today to discuss this is probably, in my opinion, the best person to have this conversation with, and that is Catherine Austin Fitz from the Solari Report. Thank you for joining me today. How are you?
Thank you. What a pleasure to be on The Last American Vagabond. I'm a huge fan.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. Thank you, Catherine. I appreciate that. Well, it's an honor to have you, because I think this is a conversation that my work tends to not necessarily miss, but I don't focus necessarily on the larger picture of the financial aspect and where this all seems to be driving, even within the pandemic nature of this illusion. So let's start off with talking about, you know, kind of that where that clip is discussing the idea of these central currencies and how the pandemic itself is sort of being used to hide that large agenda there, the financial coup d'etat, as you've been calling it.
So I'm so glad you chose to run that clip, because it's only 56 seconds, but it is one of those rare moments when a central banker decides to tell you the truth, you know, and it's I couldn't when Carstens did that. So that's Augustine Carstens, who's the general manager for the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which is sort of the central bank of the central banks. And basically what he was saying is, we can make the rules and we can turn your money on and off. Now, I mention this because plague laws have been used for centuries. This is not the first time this has happened, but plague laws have been used for centuries to control labor, to control travel, to control what a person can do. But as you can hear from listening to Carstens, digital technology brings a whole new level of invasiveness and control. And literally, the central bankers are going to be able to turn your money on and off, which means it's no longer currency or money. It's a financial transaction control grid. And, you know, when combined with all the other components that go into it, from the injections to, you know, the ability to basically stop or control your access to all the resources you need to simply survive, it's a very frightening look into a dystopic future.
Exactly. And I think that's the interesting part about this. And I love that you've made that reference before. This is not even necessarily about the fight. It's about using this as a way to control everything as it goes forward. Right. And I think you said in the past, pandemic is a new euphemism for financial coup. I believe this was in one of your Solari reports, which I have sitting right here, and the radical reengineering of global governance. On that note, since I reference it, just make sure people check out these reports. These are outstanding. It's amazing the information that's being missed here. But excuse me to finish the statement. Pandemic is the new euphemism for financial coup and the radical reengineering of global governance. And so I want to talk about this part of it, because this is a really, really fascinating part that's been used before. I think the technological aspect was here, and it's something that Derek Brose has written about called the parasite stress theory, right? And how they've done studies about how do we use this, and it even references the idea that it doesn't even necessarily need to be a real pandemic. It's the idea of this and how it drives people into accepting authoritarianism. And that study really brings up a larger, more interesting discussion in the world of technocracy and the technological world that we are driving into. So give me your thoughts on this and explain a little bit for people on the idea of what you mentioned, plague laws, and how historically it's been used to shift currencies and people's perceptions of them.
So there's a very interesting book, and there's a review on our website called The Edge of the World by Michael Pye. And he describes in the next to the last chapter how after the bubonic plague, the plague laws were created that allowed control of capital, basically a harvesting of the population, and that centralized the capital necessary to build out the first big, really big cities in Northern Europe, but also to start to shift the reserve currency. And my guess, I'm hoping we can get some graduate students to dig in and really look at this. It looks to me like there's a pattern of every 100 or so years, you have a plague, you use peg laws to centralize control, and then you shift the currency. Think of it as a reset. Now, it's unbelievably important to understand that if you look at the system that we've all grown up in America or the G7 democracies, you have a balance of power between the people voting for representatives who are then control the fiscal policy, and then bankers, private bankers who control the central bank, who control monetary policy. So you have this balance of power between fiscal policy and monetary policy with the people getting a say about where their taxes go. The bedrock of the American system is no taxation without representation. What you're watching around the world, and it's quiet for most people, they're not focused on seeing the nuts and bolts of it is, the central bankers have levered up the governments, shifted the money out of the government, so sort of stolen it out of the back door. And now that the people's representative are in essence deeply dependent financially on the central bankers and sort of the operations that they own privately, you are watching them collapse the fiscal policy control. And so they are increasingly controlling fiscal policy and monetary policy together. That is a coup. That is a change of government. And it's a very significant change in the balance of power between the people and the bankers. And so we're looking at a system which is moving to total central control. Now, in May of 2020, I wrote a very famous, what is now a famous article called The Injection Fraud. And I basically said, you know, don't fear the virus. If there is a virus, fear the injection. And what we see all over the world, the people most adamant and pushing the injection and pushing 100% mandate for the whole population are the central bankers. And that's a very interesting role for a central banker to be publicly promoting injections when in fact those injections have secret ingredients in it. And so one of the most important questions, because I know we're going to discuss transhumanism, what in the world is in this stuff? And right. The answer is, you know, we have a lot of conjecture. We have a lot of indication. I've seen a lot of pictures from some very responsible researchers, but you know, we have a group of central bankers who are operating a secret governance system with now most of the money on the planet operating behind secrecy, under control, essentially, of the central bankers and the people who run the financial system. And now they're trying to basically re-engineer our physical bodies in ways that we don't yet understand. So it's a very, it's a picture of a group of people pushing very aggressively for a frightening amount of central control. We know since the pandemic started, they've printed, you know, trillions of dollars that sort of have gotten channeled to their friends while shutting down our economy, which means they can buy our assets for pennies on the dollar. If they get the passports, they'll be able to just steal them for free.
This is something that anybody anywhere around the country or in the world, for that matter, can literally see. I mean, we've all seen these massive shopping centers that are just gone now, and we're all going to begin to see the Walmarts and the larger corporations pop up in these locations. The CARES Act, different discussions we've had on our show show you that they basically gave these larger groups money to be able to get them through the problem that they laid on everybody else. Right? It's an interesting thing.
We have 500 new billionaires since the pandemic started.
I mean, even just since Omicron's been announced.
What do you mean they're not successful? The pandemic's been wildly successful.
Exactly. It's very clear. Even since Omicron's been announced, we've saw 9 different members of Moderna and Pfizer raise billions of dollars just on the discussion of it. Right. We see how that very clearly goes. I wanted to make a point about the it's interesting that you talked about the central bankers and their push and focus on the injection. For the average person out there that, you know, and rightly so, we should be questioning everything, including the stuff we're talking about. But who might not want to think that there's more malicious stuff there, just recognize that it there's a motivation for them to push this regardless of whether it's right for you or safe for you. This altruistic lens they put to get to over all of these people today is a little bit childish, right? It's obvious that there's more motivations, if at the very least financial, to push this, whether or not it's something that's right for people or safe for people.
Well, there's no science behind these injections. You know, we know that Moderna has said basically they're loading an operating system into your body. That's Moderna's words, not mine. We know that if you look at what the adverse events and deaths that have been reported, let alone those that have been estimated by reliable sources, you know, this, well, first of all, I would say this is gene therapy. This is not a vaccination. So I just call it an injection. But we know that the things that we do know that what it does in the deaths and adverse events it's causing, they're significantly greater. You know, if you look at the pain from the injections, it's far greater than the pain from the whatever COVID-19 is. And so the solution is far more dangerous than what it is it's trying to solve. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
Especially makes no sense when you look at the effort to inject it into children who have no risk from COVID-19 whatsoever.
Right.
And they have significant risk from the injections.
Right. The solution being worse than the problem is a classic government concept that they even tried to get ahead of before this all started. But let's put a pin in that, because I want to talk more about the transhumanist concept and where that injection goes. But I don't want to get too far away from the financial part of it in the beginning here, because I wanted to shift over. So keeping in mind the idea of the plague laws and the idea of how the conversation of how this is has been used clearly to shift currencies and people's perceptions of it. I want you to talk a minute for me or for our audience about the, maybe first a quick touch on how you pronounce it differently, maybe FOSAB 56 or what that is, and how that allowed these groups to manipulate things. And then maybe talk about the G7 going direct reset with BlackRock. I want to talk about that for a minute as well.
Okay. So since 1998, there has been in the United States and possibly in other places around the world what I call a financial coup d'etat. So there is between fiscal 1998 and 2015, there is $21 trillion missing from the federal government. And for that entire period, the federal government has refused to obey the financial management laws. There was a wonderful professor from Michigan State University who helped me do a survey of all the $21 trillion. I only had the number up to $12 trillion, Ryan. And Dr. Skidmore jumped in, did a complete survey with his students, and discovered, no, the number was $21 trillion. So that was published, and great pressure was put on the Department of Defense and the Treasury to finally obey the audit laws requiring a full audit of the U.S. government. And instead, what happened was in 2018, they adopted FASB 56, Federal Accounting Standards Advisory Board Statement 56. That's our, you know, it's so hard to understand. We did a big, a series of articles to sort of make it possible for people to understand what this was. And basically what it says is that the federal government is free to keep secret books. And not only that, not tell you that they're keeping secret books and not tell you who made the decisions. So, you know, and that not only applies to the federal accounts, but to the accounts of contractors and all sorts of related entities doing business or under the umbrella of the federal government. And if you look at all the securities that those entities issues, what I would say is that combined with the classification and national security laws, the vast majority of U.S. security markets are now basically dark, and the disclosure is meaningless. You have no idea what the real income,
right,
you know, and the real financials of many of these entities are. And in addition to this piece, and you can link to it from missingmoney.solaria.com, where we keep all these materials, what this means is that we're now literally in a never-never land where there is not insufficient disclosure on the vast majority of the economy and the vast majority of the securities market in the United States. It's quite amazing now. So once they adopted FASB 56, what this meant was, you know, as one guy said, this is the, you know, the ultimate wet dream, infinite money for private armies. Hmm. And you had the system kind of spin even more out of control at that point. And I believe if they hadn't passed FASB 56, you know, the pandemic may not have ever been able to come off the way it did. For example, it was right after they adopted FASB 56. I think Moderna did an IPO of about $500 million. It wouldn't surprise me if that's where that money came from. You never know.
And on a quick side note before you continue, am I correct in assuming that that was sold as the solution to the problem when all it did is make the problem worse, sort of like a Patriot Act argument?
No, they tried to sneak that one through.
Ah, interesting.
And I think they thought they were going to sneak that one through. And a very wonderful group in Washington, the Federation of American Scientists, picked up on it, published it, and that's how Dr. Skidmore and I found out about it. And then we dove in. And then after we published the FASB 56, we were very lucky. Matt Taibbi, who's tried to follow federal finances, he picked up on it and was able to write an article about it, basically, because, you know, a couple of groups had sort of dug out the work. And so it kind of put it on the map. But here's how they tried to sneak it by. Remember the Kavanaugh hearings?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. While everybody was paying attention to the Kavanaugh hearings and you thought the White House and Congress and the Republicans and Democrats were fighting, they all got together, both Senate and House and White House, all together, and adopted FASB 56, which says as an administrative policy that they can ignore all regulations, all laws, and the Constitution with relationship to financial management. Now,
under guise of national security, right? I mean, that's kind of the argument, that it's something they can't divulge because of top secret, you know, that kind of a thing. Right.
Right. So, but understand what they did. They said, we Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and the Republicans and Trump are all going to get together while you're all distracted by, you know, Kavanaugh's sex life as a teenager. We're going to get together and we're going to delete 250 plus years of financial management code and laws and regulations and just agree that we can ignore the Constitution. Now, what I would say is, you know, there's no way an administrative policy can negate the Constitution, financial management laws, and all the financial management regulation. But that's what they agreed to do, and nobody's called them on it yet.
What a perfect example of the two-party illusion and how they use things like the Kavanaugh hearing, which, by the way, at that time, as I'm sure a lot of us did, we pointed at it as saying, this is just a, you know, it's political theater, right? And it's obvious that those things happen behind the scenes. And this is what I'm constantly trying to get people to see, is that if we can't get past the two-party divide, we will not be able to accomplish anything.
So here's what was interesting. They promulgated the administrative proposal for FASB 56 in the summer, and they sent it around in the sort of approval process, and they sent it to HUD, and you should see the comments. HUD, the housing agency, domestic housing agency, writes, oh, we really need this. This is great. You know, and you wonder, why is it that a domestic housing agency needs to keep secret books? Okay, so then, now remember, Oliver North or one Office of Naval Intelligence agent used to say that Oliver North called HUD the covert, the candy store of covert revenues. So, then they sent it to the SEC. Now, remember, this is something that's going to take the majority of the U.S. securities markets dark by a secret sort of administrative policy. The SEC says, you know what their comment was? Hmm. Now, remember, they're in charge of disclosure for the U.S. securities markets. Their comment was, no comment.
That's
no comment. We're going to delete disclosure for the majority of the securities market, and the SEC has no comment.
Which says everything.
It says everything. There's an article. If you are in the business of, you know, and this would be a foundation, a pension fund, any institution that's dependent on Treasury securities, my attorney and I wrote an article. It's public, called Caveat Emptor. It's linked from missingmoney.solaria.com, where we describe, okay, what does this mean to your credit? Because what we're talking about, and one of the things we talk about in Caveat Emptor, is the one of the top rating agencies lowered the U.S. bond rating. I think it was in 2012, in response to the kinds of things we're talking about. And the next thing that happened was the Department of Justice went after them and almost destroyed their business. Hmm. So we're talking about functioning in a world where any of the institutions that normally would bring transparency to bad behavior in the Treasury or the bond market, literally, you know, they risk corporate or financial death or death. You know,
right.
People fight over these things. So FASB 56 is a real, it was a real step towards consolidating the coup d'etat. And when the pandemic started, I assumed that it was air cover for the reset. Now, let me describe the going direct reset. After FASB 56, the central bankers who meet every year in under the auspices of the Kansas City Fed in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, had a meeting, and a plan that had prepared by a team of retired central bankers, including the former vice chairman of the Federal Reserve and the former chair of the Israeli Central Bank, Stanley, they presented a plan that they had prepared under the auspices of the BlackRock Investment Institute for the going direct reset. And the going direct reset was approved by the central bankers at that date, which is August 22nd, 2019. And literally, when everybody got back to the, you know, to their desks on Wall Street, et cetera, in the New York Fed, the Fed proceeded into the repo market, and the rest is history. Hmm. And, you know, and simply when the pandemic hit, it basically gave them the extended powers they need for even broader intervention in the markets. And it was quite extraordinary because you, within a very short order of time, you pump almost $4 trillion into private equity firms and Wall Street while shutting down the broad economy and small business. One estimate I've seen is over a million small businesses in America destroyed. And it's basically a game of economic warfare where the publicly traded stocks can pick up enormous market share and assets for pennies on the dollar. And of course, they're flush with free capital from the central banks.
And the BlackRock plan. I'm getting some feedback here
all of a sudden.
Apologies for that.
So you just put it up. The BlackRock plan is public. We did a great, I had John Titus, who joins me in Money Markets Weekly and the Solaria Report, write our annual wrap-up. And I had written State of Our Currency, which sort of framed the 20-year global financial coup d'etat and how they needed to consolidate sort of what was coming. And then I asked John to drill down and do the going direct reset, which he did. And if you come into Solari, the big study is a subscriber only, but if you put going direct in the search box, I asked John to write a couple page summary because so many people wanted a public explanation. And so the going direct was sort of the Fed piece of kicking off this going direct reset plan. And you know, and that's essentially the plan that's being implemented as we go. The next step, of course, is to take the digital system all digital, which is the danger we don't want. And to get it all digital, you need the vaccine passports, which have nothing to do with health. You know,
right.
It's funny.
Right. Before we go,
yeah,
there,
we go there,
I'm getting some feedback. I'm going to grab some headphones.
In the meantime,
could you let us know when the BlackRock plan was initiated? Oh, there we go. Looks like the feedback went away. Yep. So the BlackRock plan in general.
I just realized, It's switching my audio not to the headset. Let me see if I can.
Okay, no worries. Yeah, while you're doing that, basically, what I've discussed BlackRock from the very beginning of this pandemic discussion, and how it was very, very revealing that the plan that you're discussing, the bailout of the Fed, or you know, in our financial system, was outlined as you discussed before this started. Yet, once COVID-19 was pushed, they seemed to justify it with COVID-19 as if it was initiated because of that. So, would you touch on that for me? I actually can't hear you. I can't hear you right now, Catherine. As always, they're probably messing with us in some way to make this stuff more complicated. That's always how this goes. Well, while you're just need to unmute it probably from StreamYard down there. But I mean, the interesting part about it is that this is. It looks like she might have got disconnected. Of course, guys, this is nothing new. As you all remember. Few days ago when we were about to do this interview the first time is when all of a sudden, right before we're ready to start, everything crashed, the computer went down. This, as I've always said many times, whether or not this is censorship right now or manipulation of our platforms or throttling, this is where this will be going. This technocratic concept of control, of censorship will be, like she's mentioned before, you could turn it off out of nowhere. Suddenly we don't like what you're saying. You're saying the wrong thing. You're not supporting the right institution. You're turned off. Right? Something just like that. Now, hoping she comes back, my point was before that the BlackRock conversation is something you guys all saw. Since we have a minute, let me grab it really quick from The Last American Vagabond, where we talked about this plan. And as she pointed out, the G7 plan, going direct reset, which is actually kind of funny, the going direct reset before the Great Reset was announced, that suddenly became the Great Reset. It's the same thing. It's just something, the way they're framing this. And don't forget, as we pointed out, that Israel is involved directly with what BlackRock is doing and in the original plan that they laid out, which in 2019, which then became, in my opinion, the next part of it. We just got her back. Hey, Catherine.
Okay.
There we go.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Okay. I was just rattling off about the potential technocratic censorship, the future it's all going, even whether or not that was actually manipulation. This is the kind of stuff that we will see going forward. Like you said, that they can just shut you off. Don't like what you're saying? Well, in a technocratic future, they can just flip that switch, you know, just to fill that gap. Go ahead.
So essentially a process began in the 90s where I'm going to grossly oversimplify, all the retirement savings that the boomers were saving up for their retirement was stolen. And so now that the bank robbery is over and the money's been stolen, the question is, how do you tell people you've stolen all their money? Well, you don't. You tell them there's a magic virus, and the magic virus has stolen all the money, right?
Perfect.
It's quite remarkable. And suddenly you started to see, oh, well, the economy's in trouble because of the magic virus. And we're going to run out of money in Social Security because of the magic virus. And the pension funds are going to have trouble because of the magic virus. And, you know, blah, 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 blah. You know, and it's amazing how many people it worked with until somebody stepped up and said, look, there's a financial coup and this is how they steal your money. And here's how it works. And anyway, but if you come to Solaria and read State of Our Currency and then the Going Direct Reset, you know, it will start to make a lot more sense as to how the re-engineering, now that you've stolen the money, you have to re-engineer the governmental promises. And the pandemic gives you the power to get so much control over individuals and their assets that basically you can now steal another $21 trillion. If you can bring out CBDCs and get the vaccine passports together, that's going to give you a financial control system where, you know, if I don't want you buying pizza, you can't buy pizza. That's what Carson said. If I don't want you going more than 5 miles from your home, you can't go more than 5 miles from your home. Your credit card won't work. Your car will stop working if it's electric. Right. Do you see what I mean? So we're talking about complete spatial and economic control and the ability to shut off your money if you don't do what we want. I mean, I'll have people say, well, I don't really mind because if they want to shut me off from pizza, I really shouldn't be eating pizza. And I'm saying, no, you know, if you don't, they decide they want to bring up your kid, not you. And if you don't bring your kid down to the, you know, whatever the drop off point is, they'll shut off your money.
Right.
So,
and for those that don't, just the central bank digital currencies, that's the CBDC. That's what she's referencing. Correct. There, the digital currencies. And that's interesting where we see that It's but again, it's more than just the actual currency, right? It's the vehicle being used to get there. And I think that the BlackRock aspect of that just kind of shows how it's been planned out long before we got here. And it's just being re-evolved. And I think that that's the, I think Corbett's referenced this a lot. And I've met the idea that 9/11 itself is essentially a part one to what we're dealing with today. And you can see,
absolutely. 9/11 was a part one. And one of the reasons it was a part one, James did a fantastic video on 9/11. I forget what he called it. It was Follow the Money.
Right.
9/11, Follow the Money. And the first, we were bringing tremendous pressure. So let me step back and tell a story. Because think of this as the FASB, the first version of FASB 56, okay? So I was working with a reporter in Washington who was writing stories about all the money that was disappearing. At the time, in September 2001, there was over approximately $4 trillion missing from HUD and DOD. And a wonderful Washington reporter named Kelly Muir was writing a series of stories, and I was helping her with research. And we were about to publish a cover story in her magazine, Insight Magazine, that was automatically delivered to every congressman and senator. So it would have hit their desks on the Friday after 9/11, okay? And we'd been working on this for months, and it was an explosive story that just pulled the lid off of all the lies at DOD and HUD about why they couldn't produce financial statements and how much money was missing and how much that meant to the average American family. So on Monday, the day before 9/11 was on a Tuesday morning. Monday, September 10th, Donald Rumsfeld comes out with a press conference saying DOD is missing $2.3 trillion. Actually, the number was $4 trillion, or it's $3.4 trillion at that point, but he did sort of a modified hangout. And financial irresponsibility at DOD is a bigger problem than terrorism. And I remember that night, September 10th, saying to Kelly, you know, nothing can stop this story from going viral now. Big mistake. The next morning, of course, is 9/11. And literally, we see the buildings in New York and a part of the Pentagon that was investigating the missing money, all the documentation and investigation teams who were investigating the missing money or related securities fraud get blown up. And in fact, it was a year or two later that DOD wrote in one audit report that they couldn't produce audited financial statements because their offices had blown up in 9/11, which is ridiculous because my understanding was they were in Ohio. So you know, but it 9/11 then was helped them engineer sort of overcome the objections to the missing money, get rid of a lot of the documentation and the investigation teams looking into the missing money, get a huge appropriation for DOD, $48 billion that year. And everybody just was making money now on the wars and ignoring the homeless. You know, it pushed it all aside. And it did a lot with the laws with the Patriot Act, which I call the Control and Concentration of Cash Flow Act, to significantly move a lot of what I call the black budget on budget, and give the deep state far greater control of the fiscal side of the house. You know, so this is all part of the coup of taking control of the fiscal side of the house. So 9/11 did a big step up in shifting the financial management. And now, of course, we see the pandemic take the steps that if they can achieve them with the passports and CBDC, end democracy, end liberty, and literally return us to a form of slavery, which will be more invasive and draconian than what happened in the African-American slave trade. One of my theories as to what destroyed the African or stopped the African-American slave trade was the banks could not collateralize human beings sufficient to not lose money on the slave trade.
Right.
So the banks in London kept losing money as correspondent banks on the slave trade. So now we're talking about being able to digitize a human being and collateralize them, put them on a blockchain and make them collateral for a financial transaction system, which is literally slavery. And Carson's just explained it to you.
Right.
He will control your money. We just watched the nominee by the Biden administration for the top bank regulator, we just watched them stopped by a concerted effort by both Republicans and Democrats. She had just published an article in the Vanderbilt Law Review basically saying all of our bank accounts should be moved to the Fed. So Fed would have complete control of your bank accounts. And if inflation kicked off, the Fed could just take your money.
Yeah, a grouping of private bank companies that aren't actually associated with the federal government, which most people still don't know because they don't teach this in school. That's absolutely staggering to me. And I think that this is an obvious first step, that the technology is now available to take the next step, or maybe that's what triggered this. Now, before we get past that again, because the vaccine passport of that is the obvious next step, it's interesting to point out that in addition to all the exact people that might have insight on multiple different things instantaneously being removed from the situation with what happened on 9/11, there was a lot of interesting things that are now becoming clear before this started too. Carrie Mullis, things like that, or even a lot of HIV researchers, individuals that just kind of suddenly, you know, died in plane crashes and different things right before this started. Just to throw that out there, not to say we know for sure, but interesting. And I also think it's interesting.
Well, we've seen this pattern again and again and again. So absolutely. Right. Are these deaths suspicious? Yes. Is it possible they're all a coincidence? No.
Right. I agree with that completely.
Right.
And on top of that, I actually think in 9/11, there was an attempt to bring in the parasite stress theory concept and maybe even work to a degree with anthrax, even the threat of smallpox, right? That was thrown into the mix and maybe pulled back. And now we just see it coming full blow. I think that's just an important thing.
It's very interesting because, you know, the health cartel side of the deep state has been working for years to figure out how to use the pandemics and biowarfare to help achieve the central control.
Right.
And we've seen many efforts to get a pandemic going. I don't know if you remember the swine flu, but it was really interesting because they had gotten Massachusetts to mandate the swine flu vaccination. And suddenly the pushback took off. You had a lot of the health workers really pushing back hard and bringing lawsuits. Gary Null was one of them. And I will never forget being in Tennessee and calling one of my allies who lives about 90 miles south of you and saying, you know, if they mandate this vaccination in Tennessee, I'm not going to take it. I'm going to have a gunfight. And he said, so are we? And I said, well, here's why I'm calling. I said, you know, I hate to have a gunfight alone. Can I bring my guns and come over to your house? He said, oh, yeah, you come up. We're going to have a big old party. We're all going to bring our guns here, and we're going to have a real fight. And I think the NSA heard millions of those conversations.
Right.
And they just said, no.
Right. And that's one of the biggest factors that they don't want us to be aware of, is that there is a tipping point. To just, even if whether it's a protest, whatever it is, if there's enough people that push back, they actually can't they don't have the resources to deal with that. And there's a number that they all know. And so that's why we're always telling people that, yes, that one more person does matter, right? Everybody just has to take
one person. One person matters a huge amount. It's unbelievable. And I'll tell you why. We just, we had just put out a survey. Dr. Mark Skidmore, who did the work on the missing money, is now in the process of developing a survey. And we agreed to put the survey out to our list so that he could test it, polish it, whatever. And basically it asks people to describe their experience with COVID and then their experience, both them and their family and networks, with the injections. And it absolutely confirms what I've seen talking to subscribers for the last year and a half. The injections are causing far more disease and death than whatever the flu is that's going around. So
scientifically verified. Absolutely.
Right.
There's plenty of studies, peer reviewed and otherwise, that have come out and shown exactly what you're talking about. And it's just being disregarded.
But if you look at the pain it's causing, you know, because these are, you know, I've dealt with vaccine injury for many, many years now, because as an investment advisor, I ended up with many clients whose families had been harmed financially by vaccine injury. And vaccine injury can literally bankrupt a family.
Absolutely.
And I used to, you know, I would have some clients who were grandparents who would say to me, you know, my my son wants to vaccinate his kids and they're his kids. It's not my business. And I said, well, it is your business because you're the family bank. Your son doesn't have $5 million. And a severely autistic child or a severely neurologically damaged child from vaccines is going to cost $1 to $5 million. And that's your money. So you will have spent your whole life working your whole life to earn enough money to take care of your vaccine injured grandchild. You know, so it is your business.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I dealt with a lot. And here's the reality, and I'm sure you've seen this. These are gruesome deaths and gruesome disabilities. This is not a good death. This is not a good way to die.
And
it's so painful because it not only kills or destroys a person's life, it kills families, it kills communities. It's just...
And their relatives, like you mentioned, I mean, if this is a mother, what happens to the family and the finances for the children that are left? I mean, and this is, it's almost kind of a gross extension and probably exactly what it is of the collecting of the wealth. It's just pulling it out of every angle it can at the expense of these people.
Right. I call it, because to me, it's only part of something. And it started with the financial coup. If you look at how the financial coup started and when it started, what also started at the same time was the great poisoning. So if you look at what happened with the food, with the spraying, with the injections and the heavy schedule injections, with the encouragement to do everything they could to get the kids addicted to sugar, you're talking about a poisoning. I don't know if you've read RFK's new book, Kennedy's new book on Fauci.
Started,
but,
yes.
One of the things he points out is since 2000, the IQ points of the average American child is down 7 points.
I mean, this is what frustrates me about stuff like this. And this speaks to the propaganda machine that controls the flow of information to a degree, is that we've had studies relentlessly put out about fluoride, for instance, that show unequivocally that it lowers the IQ of children. Right. And yet it remains, it's what we're dealing with today.
So let me tell you the good news, because I'm, for the first time, so I've been at this since I came out of the Bush administration. I said, we need another plan. So I thought it was sort of emergency to come up with another plan. I thought I'd come up with another plan that could work. And then the Department of Justice landed on the top of my head. And I spent 11 years fisticuffing with them, learning more about, sort of refinements needed for the plan. And what I have seen, since then, because I really left the establishment big time in 1998. And the financial coup was hot and heavy. This is the first time that I'm seeing a critical mass of the necessary people and talent facing the fact that we can't just stay in the middle of the road.
Right.
That where the leadership wants to take it is a place which is unacceptable. It's worse than death. There's no reason to go along. You might as well fight back with everything you've got. That's a better kind of life than not fighting back.
I agree.
And we are now, and the reason I bring up RFK's book is what you see is an extraordinary example of hundreds of doctors and scientists and litigators and parents getting together and building the intelligence together. It's a leadership case in open source intelligence. Because if you look at the number of doctors, of scientists, of parents who've poured into this sort of network and vehicle, it's astonishing and it breaks through. So I've given it to people who've given it to their parents or family where they can't make a breakthrough. And then they read this book and they just realize, okay, because even I thought I knew how bad it was. I had read Judy Mikovits' books. I knew Rappaport had educated me about HIV, AIDS. I'd read Celia Farr. I thought I knew how bad it was. And then I heard Kennedy speak as he was writing the book. And I went, oh, my God, it's even worse than I thought. How could it be worse than I thought? And then you read this book. And I just thought, I missed so much of how bad it is.
Well, that's a good thing for people to know in general. And I do recommend that book as well. If it's able to break through to people that aren't listening, that's a good tool to use.
It's a breakthrough. Well, what a lot of people need to know, because a lot of people are busy and they just have a hard time fathoming that the leadership would want to go where they want to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so they need something that integrates politics with money, with science, with medicine, with, you know, political control in a way they can understand. And that's a lot of stuff that needs to be integrated. But Kennedy and his team and his networks have really done it. And it's a breakthrough. It's a break. It's like a diamond drill bit. It breaks through. And it's amazingly written, given the complexity of what they're dealing with. And so, you know, somebody who's not interested in science or medicine can read it and realize, you know, it's really this bad.
Well, that's good. I will make sure to include that in the show notes as well, because it is definitely something I recommend. Right. But bringing this back to the coup d'etat aspect of this, one aspect that I thought was really, really interesting, I've watched the Pfizer contracts sort of become the new Trojan horse NGO kind of an idea, right? Where they're using these contracts that have been like Brazil, for instance, where we're not even supposed to know this, but it got leaked out, that they have contracts that basically say if certain situations happen, they can literally take control of things like their military, state assets. And I thought that was outrageous until you start, you know, understanding what you're talking
about. If you look at how the IMF deals and the World Bank deals worked, Greg Palast did some great disclosure of how those deals worked in the early 2000s and late 1990s. And that's exactly, there were a lot of secret deals flying. The last time I looked at Pfizer stock, which was, say, 4 to 6 weeks ago, they had significantly underperformed where you might think they would be, given how many injections they've sold and sort of their lead position. And I suspect it's because they are passing out. You know, my guess, and this is an unanswered question, my question is, how much money in kickbacks is Pfizer passing out? It's basically going into countries and buying countries.
Right.
You know, so the political appointees all turn over assets contractually to the pharmaceutical, and then the pharmaceutical pays them a ton of money behind the scenes, or their wife or spouse or whatever. But my guess is the shareholders of Pfizer are not making anywhere near as much as you think, because they got a huge kickback operation going. So that's my question.
So is it really just a shell game? Is this just another Trojan horse that the NGOs were serving, that the CIA before that was serving? Are they using Pfizer as a cloak to achieve the same end? Is this part of the, you know?
Yeah. So this is part of a global change in control and coup d'etat.
Right.
They're using the IMF as well. So the IMF got huge authorizations of SDRs earlier this year, and they're running around the world saying, if you do this, this, and this, you know, you'll get, and leaders are saying no, and they're running into significant, you know, we have four leaders in Africa killed, probably the Haitian assassinated, you know, so leaders who are saying no are being assassinated or thrown out in brutal elections.
Belarus is an example of somebody who put that documentation out there and showed you that they basically said, do what you're told and you'll get this massive amount of money, billions of dollars.
Right. And you know, it's very, I've been on the, you know, I've been a target of those kinds of threats, nowhere near that kind of big money. But I've been a target of those kind of threats, you know, carrots and sticks. Hmm. And when you're in that box, it's really hard to fight back. When someone like the president of Tanzania fights back, he knows his family or he could be killed. And he was killed. I'm sure it was an assassination.
So, at the very least, historically speaking, it shows you that they're very capable of doing exactly that. And when you see the full scope of this picture, it becomes almost impossible not to ask that question.
Well, first of all, the vaccine passports are not run by the health ministry. They're being run by the financial ministry.
Right.
You know, if you go around the world, it's got nothing to do with health. And if you look at who designed the pandemic, the intelligence agencies were very involved. And one of my favorite lines from Kennedy's speech when he was talking about the book is, you know, if the CIA is designing the, you know, what is it, Pandemic 201 or Event 201, right, you know, what is their business? Their business is coup d'etat. They've engineered 40 plus coup d'etats since World War II around the world. And now they're just engineering a coup d'etat. You know, well, I would say in 1963, they did engineer a coup d'etat. Now they're just taking it to a whole new level.
Right.
But it's interesting. Earlier this year, I did a book review of Empire of Pain, which is a very well-written book on the opioid epidemic, on the Sackler family. And I had read it because if you look at when in 1995, we had a budget event in Washington, and the sort of deep state leadership was not able to engineer a budget deal that was satisfactory to them. You know, they were still trying to get the U.S. on a financially responsible basis. One of the top pension fund leaders in the country said to me about that moment, he said, they've given up on the country. They're moving all the money out starting in the fall, meaning fall, the beginning of fiscal 1998. Wow. And if you look at that moment when they quote unquote gave up on the country, it was October 1995. The next month, the HUD predatory lending kicked off and skyrocketed. Thank you, Andrew Cuomo. Cuomo's been on the, you know, on the engineering of a lot of the financial coup d'etat. But the other thing that happened that month was they approved OxyContin. And if you look at the poor neighborhoods where the pain, you know, the pill mills were, they were doing the predatory lending and the pill mills into the same neighborhoods. It was a multiple pronged attack. Anyway, so I'm reading Empire of Pain, and what I discover is the prior generation of Sacklers, their claim to fame was they had a very successful advertising agency that did Pfizer's advertising and engineered all their fraudulent marketing. So the fraudulent marketing in Pfizer has been going on for generations.
Absolutely. I try to show the Pfizer tracker as often as possible, which shows that just since 2000, they've got 71 different, you know, criminal actions, essentially $4.6 billion paid out in crimes for lying about adverse events, lying about safety. It's just staggering that this group is now being taken at face value. They say something and the media reports it, at, you know, Pfizer says. It's just very clear that this is the interconnection that you just painted right there is very obvious. And this is the kind of thing that this is why this kind of interview is so important, especially for my audience, is we need to periodically take a step back and look at what all these connections show us. You know, could it all be coincidence? Certainly possible. But I think it doesn't make sense to me. This many things could all be aligned in the same direction and it's not coordinated to some degree.
Well, because what happens was, you know, before the financial coup started, you could go into a grocery store and whether you were buying, you know, aspirin, a pain pill or food, you could trust the quality. And what has happened is, you know, the picture of that trustworthy food and drug has stayed the same, while in fact, everything's being re-engineered behind the scenes to be less and less reliable. And all the money and the media is being kept secret. So you don't see that process. It's very invisible. And yet once you know, I was forced by the missing money to look under the carpet and watch what they were doing behind the scenes. And if you look at the deterioration in quality control, I mean, if you think it's frightening on the drugs, well, you see the food. Right. And so I literally have reached the point, in America where, there are many kinds of food I will not touch because I have no idea what's in them.
I agree. No. And this is exactly the same sentiment I make about any type of, whether vaccine or otherwise, like it's the intention behind what's happening that I don't trust in a general sense. And I think let's talk a minute about the vaccine passports then and how this, in my mind, is the central point of how all of this is being driven. And I think I've been saying from the beginning that I think that the infrastructure being set up with that is the focal point. Right. Whether the vaccine is just used to get you. I mean, there's definitely things going on with that. We'll get to in a minute with the transhumanism discussion. But if they get us accepting of the infrastructure around the passport system that can then be switched to the next thing or climate change or whatever they want, so you're trapped.
Let me give you a little secret. There's a wonderful book by a venture capitalist in China called AI Superpowers. And it's basically about how China and the United States are competing to be in the lead on AI and how so much can be automated or governed using AI and software. And, you know, these two countries are racing ahead and the rest of the world is sort of falling behind is the theory. And when you read it, what you discover is the guy who wins the AI superpower race is not the guy who has the best software developers or the best AI. The thing that creates the smartest AI is the most data. So the winner is the guy who can get the most data. Now, if you're Asian, you got a couple billion people, you have an advantage. You can generate more data. But if you can digitize literally everything with nanoparticles and nanotechnology, then you can generate the most data. And there is a giant sucking sound of every cartel in the pro-centralization team trying to generate the most data so they can win and be at the table for the AI superpower race.
Let me ask you something. This is, and then let's focus on the vaccine passports. But this is something Whitney and I just recently, like maybe a few months ago, talked about. And it's really a theory, but she's talked about that same topic, legacy systems, and the discussion, right, with Eric Schmidt, and the conversation about, you know, basically removing things Americans want because it makes the government have a better chance at beating China in regard to AI. And the theory we were discussing was whether or not the point that she made is that they've been failing repeatedly to reach the singularity because they just don't have the ability to have enough data to get it correct, essentially, lack of better terms in my mind. But is it possible that COVID-19, at least in one angle of this, was an agenda to create the system that allows them to have ubiquitous access to people's data, or rather map their brains in a way to be able to reach that? Is that one angle that might make sense to you?
So this gives them, because remember, what they love to do is build. If I can make my investment, if I can have the taxpayers pay for all my expenses for free, then my return is infinite. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, and if I can get the government to help me go faster and blow by lots of rules and regulations, then my return is faster. So whether it's to cut through the red tape, you know, like, that's your asset, not mine. Oh, let me make life simple and just take it and push you out of the way. So whether it's to help me go faster or to do it with free money, the pandemic gives them the ability to centralize control. So the number one thing they need to implement this system is they need to install the smart grid.
Right.
So they need to build out massive amounts of hardware and the 5G systems, and for all we know, get the nanoparticles, you know, in your body. So, you know, whether it's getting the satellites up or the cables into your neighborhood or the towers around you or 5G loaded, they're trying to build out the whole infrastructure. I think you probably know we publish a series of sort of comparisons of where the central bank headquarters were around the country, where the Fed offices were versus where there were riots and opportunity zones, because that would dramatically improve the ability to build out the smart grid in those locations, which is logical.
Right.
You know, you're going to want really great smart grid installations around all of the Fed headquarters. And I think we found riots, you know, nearby in 34. And enormous continuity between where the riots were and where the opportunity zones were, you know, which meant money was coming in and it wanted to buy properties up cheap. And of course, that's the, you know, if you burn down what's there, you can get them much cheaper. So I think the first step was building out the hardware. But then the second step is, how do you get the people onto the smart grid with the controls that you want? And all the different things we're talking about today facilitate doing that. And of course, keeping them there requires an all digital financial system. And it's not, you know, it's not about the current system versus other new systems. It's about, do we want an all digital system? Because the danger is in an all digital system, particularly if you can use blockchain to basically make a human being collateral.
Right. Right, exactly. And this is something that your interview, most recent, I believe, with Corbett made a really good point on, the collateralization, right, of, you know, we are being turned into some, like the point you made at the beginning about slavery and the idea that historically before, right, they weren't able to do so. Now the technology is here to make that happen. And I think that the vaccine part of that and possibly what you're discussing, which could be inside of it, is an idea that could lead to using that to fully map out something that they haven't been able to, is kind of the point I was getting at. And I think it's certainly something we should ask. But so back on the vaccine passport conversation, I think that that is obviously the first step in that direction, right? And I think, right, that what they're using this as is kind of coaxing you into this under a guise of the threat, right? So give me your thoughts on the vaccine passports and how that is being used right now as the first step, and where you see it going after this.
So the vaccine passports is a piece of the control system. And the first part of it is, if you look at the vaccine passport apps, they anticipate a series of seven shots. I'm assuming it will turn out to be, you know, one a month or one every 6 months or one regularly, whatever they're trying to get into our body or to calibrate and to manage. You know, there are lots of different theories. If you look at what the shots are doing that we know for a fact, you're definitely going to reduce the population, and you're definitely going to, or it's a very high percentage, you're going to make women sterile. So one of my questions is, now that CRISPR technology is available, do they want to control what genes come into the world? So rather than let people naturally have children and that process determine the genes that come into the world, do they want, you know, do you literally have to go to them and get approval to have a baby, and it's going to be the genes they choose for you?
What an excellent point that is, too. I mean, we've constantly focused on the, you know, co-opting nature in general. Like, anything natural is now the problem, right? And we're going the other direction. So that just perfectly fits in that discussion.
Right. I don't know if you've seen the little videos where they're proposing you keep your baby growing in an incubator in the living room so you don't have to be bothered to carry them around.
Wow.
It's
shocking. It's scary stuff. I mean, we're seeing them try to rationalize and justify and even make it seem like, I mean, this is the way they frame all of this is, it's going to be better for you. Everything's going to be better. It's going to be more equitable. It's going to be more money. And none of that's actually true. Everything they're doing, as I think you pointed out, technocracy itself actually removes money from the situation, as opposed to the other way around.
I do think that the technology that they would like to bring out is very powerful and will create enormous wealth. But that wealth, what they're doing is setting into a system where they don't have to share any of that wealth.
Right. Yeah. 2030, you own nothing and you've never been happier. Right. That's their.
Right. So what I hear is, it's 2030. We've stolen all your assets.
Right.
And we've mind controlled you.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
You know, and basically, so, you know, but they're envisioning, I mean, part of their problem is, if they bring out the technology I suspect they're going to bring out, how do they risk manage that technology? They're very scared of bringing out certain kinds of energy technology because a few people can get it and weaponize it. And how do you manage and control that? Mm-hmm. So complete control solves that problem. You know, but I also think by controlling the genes that come into the world, they can very much experiment or play with or change the, you know, I hate to see this, you know, having lived in a farming community for many, many years, if you studied livestock management, it's a lot clearer what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they are trying to move from a model of a sovereign individual who has a certain amount of discretion as to how they live their life, where they live their life, whether they own and control a business, et cetera. They're trying to move the image from a sovereign individual under divine authority to basically a human as a natural resource, like a barrel of oil.
Right.
So this really is a slavery model, and it really is livestock management. And at that point, you want to be able to control, you know, who your livestock breeds with and what kinds of, you know, breeding characteristics are in the next generation. Unfortunately, if you adopt a vaccine passport, then they can force you to turn over your kids. They will take the children.
Which is already happening. There's multiple examples of people who say not wanting to give the injection and so on, and being and the happening in real time in courts that aren't even about the vaccination discussion. It's just that's a sidestep to a mayoral dispute. And they go, oh, you don't have the vaccination? Well, we're taking your kids. I mean, it's already happening in multiple places. But I don't know if you know, I'm sure you did actually, that the next part of the Great Reset is called the Great Narrative. And that kind of speaks to what you're talking about, is they're saying, well, we're going to set the narrative. We're going to set the idea about what this is and how you're going to perceive it. And then we're going to execute it. So they're already trying to get ahead of the control of how we perceive what they're rolling out. And
well, it was really funny. I had a great CJ Hopkins lives in Berlin, and he came up this summer and we filmed a documentary that'll come out later this year. And I was talking, we were having a kind of, it's sort of like, I don't know if you've ever seen what is it, Dinner with Andre or something, but you know, we did it around different meals. And at dinner, I was sitting with him and I was saying, CJ, how is it you can figure out all their, you know, as soon as the spin comes out, he's got it nailed. I said, how do you do that? He said, I'm a playwright. I invent worlds. So when I watch them trying to invent a world, I know exactly what they're up to because that's my business. I invent worlds.
That's funny.
but it's this narrative thing. And you know, the beauty of understanding how they're trying to invent our world, I think, is it then teaches you how we can invent our world. Because right. part of the problem with all the narratives they're spinning is these are worlds that are not human. And if we want to have a human civilization, we have to design and share and build our own narrative.
Yes.
Because narratives are very important.
Exactly.
Narratives are very important.
And then the discussion around that very part of it is very clear why that's so important. But that's a perfect segue into the discussion of the transhumanism concept and how the vaccine itself is a clear part of that. And I've gone very deep on the conversation of nanoparticles versus nanotechnology and the overlap and what. So my audience is very primed on what this is and why it's important and why both are dangerous. All of it can be dangerous. But so first, give me your thoughts on the nanotechnology aspect of the vaccine and then the connection, if any, in your mind to what's happening in the transhumanist direction going forward.
So I believe they're trying to load, as Moderna says, an operating system. And the whole goal of the mRNA technology is basically to create an operating system. And then through that pipeline, they can just, insert lots of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so they're literally trying to engineer the code into your body into something that they can control. And I don't begin to understand how that technology could work. Now, if you look at what's in this stuff, I'm just going to make a couple of what Dr. Farrell would call high octane speculation. What I'm seeing is very, very different patterns. So I think they're experimenting with different batches. I don't know if you've looked at any of the bad batch material, but that's clearly going on. There's saline solutions going into certain places. So there's a very wide dispersion of different things going on and happening. But what we're watching is, there's clearly invisible particles in them. I've had multiple confirmations from multiple sources that you've got these tiny stainless steel particles in that. You've got a variety of other heavy metals, including lead. And if you just look at what the Japanese came up with on stainless steel, why are we injecting millions of tiny stainless steel particles invisible to the human eye into people's bodies? What could that possibly be for? Now, I'm sure there's a logical reason why, but I don't know. Clearly, I always believe some of the materials in the global spraying were meant to create receivers in your body. One guy who was a retired CIA senior covert operations try and persuade me in the 90s that the materials in the spraying would coagulate, sort of aggregate in your body and create organic bar chips. And that's what the big things at the airport were to kind of calibrate the system. He was a professional liar. I didn't believe him, but every year that goes by, I think, could that be true?
Right.
And the reality is it's not just what's in the injection. We have a wonderful interview with a former professor of agriculture, used to be in military intelligence, Don Huber, and about sort of the mysterious ingredients that are being put in the food. So it's in the spray, it's in the food, it's in the injections. We have a lot of tiny particles which are not natural and shouldn't be going into our bodies, but are.
Right. And this was kind of my point before about hypothetically asking whether just metal, nanoparticles, nanotechnology, nanobots, whatever we're talking about hypothetically could be to get this in everybody ubiquitously to be able to map and reach that singularity. That's certainly a possibility. And go ahead, get a thought.
Well, if you read some of the best books, I spent 10 years trying to understand what the whole vaccination heavy schedule process was about. And one of the best sources I ever found were Forrest Moretti's books. He's got four on vaccinations and the effort to get metal into people's bodies. For 100 years, the leadership has been trying to figure out how to make our bodies compatible with heavy loads of metal.
Interesting.
And if you look at, you know, if you look at the deterioration of health in America, you know, it's directly related to the amount of heavy metals that people are ingesting.
Right.
So the question is,
in the UK, directly connect, tied to aluminum, right? And that's something that's being sprayed regularly.
Right. And so the question is this somehow to improve our connectivity with robotics and, you know, telecommunications and digital technology, or are they simply trying to weaken the population?
Yeah.
You know, here's the thing. I believe that these are all questions that we can figure out. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to ask the questions and to research the material. But there is no doubt the leadership is trying to get massive amounts of heavy metals into our body. And the reaction of most people is to, you know, is to weaken them or make them sicker.
Right.
So well, now.
Oh, go ahead.
So transhumanism, do they somehow think that figuring out how to get this a higher concentration of heavy metals into our body is going to somehow make us better, stronger? You know, you'll hear many of them talk about how we will not be able to compete unless they can hook us up to AI, and, you know, AI can be our brains and we'll all be part of the Borg. You know, I don't buy any of this stuff, but you know, there are lots of people who seem to believe it. And AI can certainly make certain functions faster or certain kinds of computation phenomenally faster, but it can also make complex processes in a living world more stupid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So,
and that's the point that's been made a lot in the past that and that's kind of the same point that Whitney was making in that regard, is that it's only as smart as the data that you're putting into it. And so they keep failing at that, you know, but there's a lot of different ways that this could be definitely used. And we can see that cross about I've gone back many times and referenced something. I think it was from 2003, if I remember correctly, off the top of my head. They talked about the Mew chip, which was, I think it was at the time, was like the eighth the size of a grain of salt. This was literal smart dust all the way back then. And it's like, yet we wonder what they could possibly be doing today. And they come out with discussions of little chips and showing like, this is the newest thing and it's in their fingers. And I'm thinking, well, that's ridiculous, because then 20 years ago, they had a chip that was the size of dust that would work on your body's energy, right, your motion. So I asked the simple question, whether that's like to what you're saying, whether it's already been being sprayed and this is just the next aspect of that, like you talked about, the operating system.
Oh, I think they've been experimenting all along for decades.
Yeah. I mean, these are valid questions that should be asked based on what we absolutely know today. And I think that's the interesting part of this. But to take another step over to like on that same vein, actually, the food system. Right. You mentioned this in previous interviews that like in our water and our food, like, do you believe that there's already potentially nanotechnology or some kind of manipulation already happening there? Or is that just the poison aspect you were talking about?
I think consumer products have been coming, you know, into our house with nano dust. I think they've been spraying nanoparticles, you know, all around the atmosphere, trying to digitize the whole atmosphere. I think, you know, I think this stuff is in the food. It's everywhere. Hmm. So, you know, that's from everything I've seen and everything I've read and everything, I guess. I just think, you know, this has been going on for a while now, and the injections are just an acceleration of that process. And the question is, you know, it clearly hasn't been working the way they're doing it. They wouldn't be doing the injections the way they're doing, I don't think, unless. And it's, you know, it's phenomenal. Remember, you have a group of people who are struggling to manage a population which is growing. And it's not only growing, it's growing whereby you have a whole world in Asia that wants to go up the scale per capita, which pushes enormous stress on resources and the sort of political systems. So that's a population and a change that is extremely difficult and risky for the leadership to manage. And it gets more dangerous because technology can be weaponized by small groups of people. So that's part of the push for central control. Another part of the push for central control is they want to become a multiplanetary civilization, which means if you're going to interact with another group on another planet, you need a central bank for the planet. So part of this is the, you know, is putting together the central bank for the planet and sort of dealing with that. The final thing is, if you look at the financial reset that has to happen, and it has to happen. If you look at where we are, we have to reset. If you look at the environment, you know we have to reset. Their problem is to create a great currency. Because remember, we're ending currencies. We're not creating a great concern. We're ending currencies. To create a great currency, you need a rule of law. And to have a rule of law, you need a world and a culture that will support the covenant of the rule of law. And they have no idea how to bring that about globally. You know, so they're planning on ending currencies and doing it with total digital control and force because they think they can do that. I think it's a mistake. I think there's another way to go, you know, but the problem is the other way to go will force you into meritocracy. And that means the people in control now could end up dead or not in control or, you know, in a mess because meritocracy is messy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess this leaves us with the question of how do we stop this, right? Like, what are our solutions going forward? I know we've talked about, you know, one thing I want to propose that we talk about to end here is your discussion of No Cash Fridays or, you know, things that we would take actions now so, to try to stop. Go ahead.
So the first thing we can do is, you know, I'm borrowing an ally's statement, resist. Do not get a QR code. Throw away, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to completely throw away my smartphone. Mm-hmm. Get as non-digital as you can. Now, we're talking on a digital mechanism because we're all dependent on them. So right. I'm not saying, you know, be sensible. I'm not saying going to the woods and, you know, eat beans or something. But anything you can do, what we have to stop an all-digital financial system, whether it's through JP Morgan Chase or Bitcoin. It doesn't matter. We don't want all digital.
Right.
And so the idea of Cash Friday, in fact, it wasn't my idea. It was Mary Holland's idea. we were talking about how important it was to not go all digital. And, of course, where I come from in America, Friday's a big day to do these, you know, dress down on Friday. We have those Friday days. So Mary said, well, what about Cash Friday? And I said, what a fabulous idea. And it was off and running. So the idea is, you know, just spend cash on Friday. Just And a lot of our subscribers are now doing cash every day. So,
I said no cash Friday. Cash Friday. Only use cash Friday.
Only use cash on Friday. If you come into Solaria, we have these memes. You know, every week we have a new meme. And it's a lot of fun. People are having fun. But it's an action everybody can take. It can make a very dramatic impact on taking things away from all digital. And what's happening is people are having a lot more conversations with their local businesses about what's really going on and what they do about it. And of course, it's a lot less traceable. So, you know, this is part of getting the opposite. You know, they want passports and QR codes. We want to go in the completely opposite direction. So that's one. But the other thing is do everything you can to get the bad dogs out of your pocketbook and out of your assets. And move your cash flows to people and businesses and institutions that really do good. So now's my chance because we're approaching a, you know, sort of close to the end of our interview where I always have to pitch independent media because there's old media and there's new media. Right now, when we watch old media, we put money in their pockets because the central bankers absolutely support them when we watch them. One of the things we can all do is start putting money into independent media. And you and Taylor and Derek and Whitney and your whole team at American Vagabond has done a great job.
Thank you.
You've done a great job covering this pandemic, but you're doing a great job. You know, I love the scene of the American Vagabond with the road. And you
I
start with
it myself when I was really? Traveling in Spain. Yeah.
You start with a fire. And to me, we sort of crossed the Rubicon with the North California fires. I don't know why you chose the fire, but it always really touches me.
Yeah. I think it's very, it just in every way, it seemed relevant to where we are kind of like back and forth with it. You know, we're fighting through
right.
it. We're fighting,
right.
you know, that, it feels that way right now for sure.
Right.
You know,
it does anyway, but one of the things everybody listening to this, I'm sure they support you, but you know, anything they can do to support you and your team and sort of put that money in your pocket would be, I would appreciate, because I think we have to bring transparency and we have to have an honest conversation. And that's what builds our connection and gives us the ideas to keep moving. So absolutely keep supporting and put money in the independent media's pocket. Very, very, very critical. And find other people. One of the things that most upset me over the last 2 years is people kept saying, you know, there's nobody like me around. Wrong. There are millions of people just like you. They don't like what's going on. They're concerned. You gotta find your tribe. And if you haven't found your tribe, find them and start working on building local resiliency. If you can find people around you, just start building local resiliency. And, you know, local resiliency is food. Local resiliency is water. Local resiliency is energy. Local resilience is shelter. And just start networking and finding your tribe and work with them on practical ways of improving the integrity of your food, your energy, and your shelter. And I'm looking at you because you're in Tennessee, and there are awesome resources in Tennessee to do that. But everywhere in the world, there are awesome resources. And as we find ourselves, we can do this. And stop building the prison. If you're going to work in helping them build the prison, you know, just stop. You don't have to do it.
I love that quote that you've said before. That what I had it written down here. Basically people are saying, well, we want to continue profiting from the construction of the prison, but we want you to go ahead and stop building that prison. Which doesn't make sense, right? We need to recognize that we need to divest ourselves from this broken system. Stop supporting them. Vote with your dollar, as we've all continued to say. We need to support the right. It's Captain Austin Fitz, TLAV, anybody else. Support those that are supporting you.
Right. But it's a journey. You know, when I first realized, it was 1998 when I suddenly realized, you know, I need to come clean. I need to stop financing these people.
Right.
And it took me a long time. We have a great article at Solari called How to Find a Good Local Bank, you know, because step one is you find a good local bank. And you know, there's still, America's very lucky. There are a lot of great local banks still in America. So it took me years to kind of slowly move my purchases and my bank deposits and my investments and, you know, where I spent my time out of this building the prison construct and into really high integrity, productive people and banks and financial institutions and other things that work for me, because you got to do it in a way that works for you, and change takes time. So it's a journey. But just begin, because what I'm trying to do when I say don't build the prison is get the risky, dangerous people out of your life, get them out of your life, get them out of your head, get them out of your pocketbook.
Right.
You know, just, I call it coming clean, clean them out, and shunning them will, you have no idea if everybody in America tomorrow just woke up and canceled their JP Morgan Chase credit card or bank account. Oh my God, there'd be a revolution. It'd be amazing.
Right. Go ahead.
No, I just, it would be amazing. It matters. And I have people say, well, you know, I'm too unimportant. Wrong. In a highly leveraged financial system, you have much more power than you know.
Right. That's what I was going to say, is that the real takeaway here to end is that I think everything you've been talking about and what is simply the reality is that every single one of you out there listening right now can make a difference. And that's not hyperbole, right? Go out there and choose to not use cash on Fridays, or like she says, or excuse me, to use cash on Fridays. Or as Catherine says, use it every day, right? I mean, if that's something feasible for you, every single choice in time you do that, you are making a difference. And we all need to do that in every possible way.
Right. And if you ever say you're not important, I want you to know you are important to me.
Yes, yes, exactly. Right. And something we've been saying a lot, you're not alone, right? We have people like us. There are other independent media, but I love that, right? And I feel the same way. You out there, you're important to me. You're important to Catherine. You're important to us. Keep fighting, because it's obvious that you're making a difference. You know, I just love that.
Absolutely. You know, I don't know if you've noticed, but in the last week, do you see how many judges are pushing back? We have two decisions in the 5th District. There's something in the 6th District. Somebody in South Carolina, Georgia, a judge in Georgia. You know, these mandates are, the pushback is extraordinary.
Yeah. I mean, it's very inspiring to see how, even though they know that they will be attacked, these people will, they know that they might lose their jobs. They're standing up for you, right? So that's why I keep saying,
A judge could lose his life. And they do. So these are very brave actions, and they're compounding because I think what people are seeing, you know, I keep telling everybody, death is not the worst thing that can happen. Fight now and fight as hard as you can, because it's only going to get worse. If you go along, it's going to get much worse for you. Much, much worse. So right. You might as well fight now, because at least we're having fun, you know, and we're both going to end up, you know, if we don't win, we'll end up in the slaughterhouse too, but at least we didn't make it happen and we didn't lead people in. So,
right.
You know, another great thing that's happening, I keep getting reports that as the mandates force the doctors and nurses out, they're coming out and telling all.
Right.
And telling what they've really been seeing with these injections. And that's, you know, it's like an infection. It has to rise to the surface. And I would much rather see it rise to the surface and get dealt with than, you know, keep it hidden the way it's been for years and years and years. So
completely agree.
Yeah. So bring it on. It's, you know, it's a Beck Brothers thing. Can we tell the Beck Brothers story?
Oh, yeah, exactly. Go ahead. I forgot the reference in the beginning. Go ahead.
So I love Yellowstone, which is a TV series written by Taylor Sheridan starring Kevin Costner. And the protagonist, played by Kevin Costner, is John Dutton, who runs the largest ranch in Montana. And everybody's trying to steal his land. It's really, you know, it's the war over property rights in America. But the people who write it, it's got a great cast. And I used to live in Montana, so I love watching the Montana, you know, the cinematography is just
beautiful.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
Anyway, but in the second season, there's this group locally, these two brothers, their name is the Beck Brothers, and they, you know, they're just dirty players. They just cheat, they lie, they steal. They're like the Montana neocons.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, you know, people keep trying to do deals with them and sort of cooperate with them or get them to stand down. And finally, Dutton realizes, look, there's only, you know, because they've kidnapped his grandkid, they've poisoned his cattle. He realizes, you know, you just got to kill these guys. Anyway, so one of his sons, is a retired special forces officer, and he's assigned to kill one of the Beck brothers, and he corners them in the bathroom, and at the last episode of the second season, and he thought, you know, the kid doesn't want to have to kill another human being, you know, he started killing, and he looks at the Beck brother and he says, why do you make it do it? And these, remember, right now they've kidnapped his son, so he's trying to get his son back, and the Beck brothers looks at him and he says, nobody ever fights back, meaning crime pays.
Right.
And I've said for decades, crime that pays is crime that stays. And so one of the most prescient calls I ever made, you know, every year we do an annual wrap up, which we publish in January. And in January 2020, 2 months before they started COVID-19, but after they voted for going direct, I said the number one issue before us is, what are we going to do about the Beck brothers? Because you can't avoid them anymore. And they think nobody fights back.
Right. I mean, everything as long as I've been doing this show, I think our work highlights that exact fact. Like right. Wells Fargo is a good example of someone who continues to break the law and they just go, here's $1 million fine. You know, they write that into the cost of doing business. If no one ever fights back, then they'll continue doing exactly what they've always done. And I think that's a perfect note to end on. Go ahead.
Right. Well, part of it is we're financially dependent on the fraud. And right. That's the challenge for all of us. How do we change our own money and our own lives and get on a much more productive footing so that we are not financially dependent on the checks that are coming out of that machine?
Right, right. Again, divest from that prison, right? They are building the prison, as James Corbett calls the digital gulag. It's being built around you right now, right? And if we keep investing in it, it's going to keep getting built, even if we don't like that prison, right? We need to stop. Stand back. Yeah. So thank you so much for joining me, Catherine. It's a great pleasure speaking with you. Is there anything? Go ahead.
Yeah, I want everybody to go to your website and donate some money. That's what I'm going to do next.
Well, thank you, Catherine. I appreciate that. And likewise, to Catherine's Solari Report and anything else that she's involved in, please make sure you check it out and support her as well. Would you like to give anybody else some links or anything else to reach you before we take off today?
So, yeah, our website is solari.com. We have a great update list. You can sign up. We have tons of content, and we try and post. We'll post a link to this interview. I do a lot of interviews. If you want to start to understand the Going Direct Reset, do a search for Going Direct Reset, and you'll pull up the summary did There's a wealth of information. We have a wonderful series that we sponsored Corey Lynn of Corey Diggs to do on vaccine passports, four parts. Nice. So state of our currency, going direct reset. We're just about to publish the hard copy on CBDC and then vaccine passports. You know, we've been trying to break down all these different pieces so that people can understand, you know, that they're marching us into the slaughterhouse before we get there. So back off if you have to, throw away your smartphone and use cash on Friday.
Absolutely. Great words to end on there. And I'll make sure to include all that in the show notes for you. And so everybody
have
out there,
have a great day.
Thank you as well. And as always, everybody out there, question everything. Come to your own conclusions. Stay vigilant. Yes.
Today, the job of building this nation geographically is completed. There are no new frontiers within our borders. So, to what new horizons can we look now? Where are tomorrow's opportunities? What's ahead for you, for your children? The frontiers of the future are not on any map. They are in the test tubes and laboratories of the great industries.
The Jacobardi case was one of the great judicial moments in world history, and the public was totally unaware it was actually happening as the process was being engaged. General Electric and Professor Jacobardi went to the patent office with a little microbe that eats up oil spills. They said they had modified this microbe in the laboratory, and therefore it was an invention. The patent office, the U.S. government, took a look at this, quote, invention, and they said, no way. The patent statutes don't cover living things. This is not an invention. Turned down. Then General Electric and Dr. Jacobardi appealed to the U.S. Customs Court of Appeal. And to everyone's surprise, by a 3-2 decision, they overrode the patent office.
We bring good things to life.
And they said, this microbe looks more like a detergent or a reagent than a horse or a honeybee. I laugh because they didn't understand basic biology. It looked like a chemical to them. Had it had an antenna or eyes or wings or legs, it would never have crossed their table and been patented. Then the patent office appealed. And what the public should realize now is the patent office was very clear that you can't patent life. My organization provided the main amicus curiae brief. If you allow the patent on this microbe, we argued, it means that without any congressional guidance or public discussion, corporations will own the blueprints of life. When they made the decision, we lost by 5-4, and Chief Justice Warren Burger said, sure, some of these are big issues, but we think this is a small decision. 7 years later, the U.S. Patent Office issued a one-sentence decree. You can patent anything in the world that's alive except a full-birth human being. We've all been hearing about the announcement that we have mapped the human genome, but what the public doesn't know is now there's a great race by genomic companies and biotech companies and life science companies to find the treasure in the map. The treasure are the individual genes that make up the blueprint of the human race. Every time they capture a gene and isolate it, these biotech companies claim it as intellectual property. The breast cancer gene, the cystic fibrosis gene, it goes on and on and on. If this goes unchallenged in the world community, within less than 10 years, a handful of global companies will own directly or through license the actual genes that make up the evolution of our species, and they're now beginning to patent the genomes of every other creature on this planet. In the age of biology,